This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
My guiding mantra over the past over a decade has been start with the visceral, move to the cerebral, and then at the political. And I truly believe that providing people with tasty food is one of the first steps to getting people to be more activated around food issues.
When you think about living sustainably, what comes to mind first? Driving less, recycling, avoiding plastics? For today's guests on Sea Change Radio, sustainable eating is what tops their list. First, we hear from Novella Carpenter, who recently co-authored a how-to on urban farming. Carpenter explains how she came to this topic and why raising rabbits might be a practical way to have a meat-rich but sustainable diet. After that, I talked to Bryant Terry, chef, author, and food justice activist who's as passionate about social justice as he is about great-tasting food. Whether it's farming in your own backyard or making vegan food that's no less satisfying or flavorful than a meat lover's feast, what these guests have to say will give you a practical guide for how to eat in a way that's healthy for both the body and the planet. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author and urban farmer Novella Carpenter. She's the co-author of The Essential Urban Farmer. Novella, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So you wrote this with your friend and co-author Willow Rosenthal. Tell us the inspiration for putting this rather lengthy explanation of what it takes to farm in an urban environment together.
It's a real doorstop, isn't it?
Ironic for a woman named Novella that she would write such a large tome here.
So Willow and I met in Oakland. We were both living in West Oakland in the early 2000s. And Willow was doing a program called City Slicker Farms. She's the executive director of this nonprofit. And their whole goal was to grow fresh food for people who are more like low income, and they would have a farm stand, basically a free farm stand, and they'd grow food on these empty lots in West Oakland. Because if you've ever been to West Oakland, it's sort of like it's been bombed out, kind of, you know, houses have burned down and there's no development, there's no grocery stores, things like that. And so that was her project, and I had just moved there to Oakland from Seattle, Washington, and I had had bees and chickens in Seattle, and I was a little bit of the eccentric lady in my neighborhood. And I didn't really have a name for what I was doing. I was just kind of interested in growing my own food. My parents are back to the land hippies. And so I had this like sense of like, you know, fresh food is good, but I don't want to like go live out in the country because I hate to drive and whatever. So then I was at a party with Willow, and I started talking to her, and I was like, oh, what do you do? She's like, I'm an urban farmer. And I had this like click, you know, where I was like, urban farm, that is what I am. I'm an urban farmer too. And so it was this like awesome moment of self-recognition that this is what I've been doing. Cause I've always been trying to explain what I do. You know, it's like, yeah, I just, you know, I have keep animals in the city, and people are like, what, like dogs? And I'm like, no, goats, you know? So, anyway, so Willow and I would always get these questions from people at parties, or we get emails from people who are like, hey, you know, what should my chicken coop look like? And, you know, like, I'm really going to be able to write an email back like, okay, do this and do this and do this. And so we thought, you know, we should really write a book. So that's why we wrote this book. I had written a book called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, and it was really it had done really well and was popular. And so I was getting all kinds of random questions from people in like Michigan for, you know, how to raise goats or something. It took us 3 years to write the book because it is, like, as you said, so extensive. So lots of diagrams and illustrations and photos. There's my favorite is the rabbit genitalia photo in the book, because we wanted the book to be what we needed when we started farming and we didn't have a guide. And you know, like we'll talk about this, but it's urban farming in the city. It's farming in the city is very different from rural farming. In rural farming, no one's in your business. You know, you can kind of pretty much do whatever you want, but in urban farms and city settings, you're so close to your neighbors. You really have to consider their needs and be considerate of them. So this book is striving to answer those questions that we wish we had the answers for when we first started.
So what are some of the best ways to deal with crabby neighbors in terms of what animals to raise and what kind of practices to live by?
Well, you know, the main thing is crabby neighbors are tough because if they don't like you already and then they see that you're getting chickens, we're going to have some problems, right? And in most cities you have to check your city ordinances, but you know, sometimes it's legal to have chickens, sometimes it's not. For us, I think the best way to convince people is through the belly. So you bring them some fresh chicken eggs, and there's nothing like a fresh chicken egg. Like a freshly laid egg is a thing of beauty and awe. It's just nothing like you would get at the farmer's market, at the grocery store, nothing. They're so delicious and fresh. So usually, you know, get kind of offering them fresh produce, fresh chicken eggs, honey, if you're going to keep bees, to get them excited about it. Now, there's our, you know, beekeeping. It's, you know, that's 30,000 stinging insects, right? So if you have a neighbor who's going to be crabby, we recommend that you actually go around and ask people before you keep bees, especially because what if they're allergic to bees and then you cause someone's death? I mean, that's just like not what we want to happen. So definitely we recommend you go around and ask the neighbors, are you allergic to bees? Because I'm thinking about getting honeybees and, you know, here's what it's going to be like. And I'm going to give you some of the honey. And, you know, and especially for people with kids, they're pretty psyched about chickens, especially because, you know, we take kids to the zoos all the time or to little farms or petting zoos. But you could have a little petting zoo in your backyard and you wouldn't have to, you know, drive there.
And talk about the rabbit genitalia for a second. Why the extensive rabbit genitalia diagrams in here?
Well, this is a bit of a controversial subject because my parents, is back to the land hippies, it was one of the main things that hippies raised was rabbit because they breed like rabbits. So
yeah, I wonder why there aren't, why it's an expensive meat, why it's become a boutique
super boutique.
But why is it because they're cute and we only want to have marshmallow versions of them for Easter? Or can we actually... I mean, it seems like their life cycle, even on a mass scale, I wonder why there aren't industrially farmed rabbits.
Rabbits are a little bit more of a hothouse product, you know, like you couldn't raise them super, super industrial because they are prone to get diseases in close quarters. And so they're
not. Even when you pump them full of antibiotics the way we do with our cows and chickens.
I know, right, maybe, but I wouldn't recommend that. I think there's not a huge demand for rabbit. I think it is a boutique industry. There's a place called Devil's Gulch here up in Sonoma County that raises rabbits. And they raise a ton of rabbits. They probably have 1,000 rabbits. So they're getting close to being a large scale operator. For meat. They sell all of their meat to, they can't keep up with demand. That's why they keep getting more and more barns of rabbit. But yeah, no, definitely. And then in the East Coast, it's definitely like a, you know, there's a most of the Polish butchers, they sell rabbit. It's a big thing. And there are producers there in the East Coast too. But yeah, it's kind of a specialty product that people aren't like clamoring for, because honestly, most people, and this is why rabbits are controversial, when I'm like, yeah, I raise rabbits for meat, you know, it's kind of like me saying, yeah, I love dog meat, you know, because it's kind of like people have rabbits as pets. And so there's this whole group called the House Rabbit Society. And they're all about having their rabbit live in the house with them and sleep with them and being cuddly. And my point is, you know, I don't want to eat your rabbit, but my rabbits are meat rabbits. And that's what they do. Once I taught a rabbit raising class in New York, I set it up in Brooklyn. I taught it at this great place called Roberta's in Bushwick. But it was highly controversial. The New York Times did a story about the class, and they had so many people call in or write in to say that I am canceling my subscription because of this story about raising rabbits for meat, that they pledged to never run a rabbit story ever again. It's definitely in America. It's like, oh my God, you eat rabbit? It's a scandal. And so it is hard to find. I think I often don't find it at grocery stores. Like I don't see it at Whole Foods, for instance.
How many rabbits were you raising at one point?
At the highest point, I had about 20 rabbits.
How many did you need for your pot pie party?
For my pot pie, I think we processed, which is a nice word to say, instead of kill. Butcher is like a little bit of a misnomer because that's just the animal's dead and you're cutting it up. So,
I see.
Yeah. I think we killed about 10 rabbits for the rabbit pot pie thing, and it made.
And how many would that feed?
That fed, we had about, God, how many pot pies do we have? We sold about 50 pot pies. So, you know, not a huge amount, but enough to kind of go
and
around.
For four adults, if you were like comparing that to like a chicken roast, how many rabbits or one would run rabbit that you were raising be enough meat for, like, is that half a pound of meat, a pound of meat? How much do you get from
each
one rabbit?
Each rabbit is about, it depends on when you harvest it, but it's about 3 pounds.
Oh, really?
So they're not huge, but, you know, and I always think that if you had four people, it's perfect for three people. You know,
that's a lot of meat.
It's a lot
pound
of
pound a person.
Well, you know, there's some bones in there and stuff. It's not like completely boneless, of course. And the best part of the rabbit is the loin, which is this. It's like a rabbit is similar to a pig. If you're butchering it, it's similar. So there's this long loin in the back that's super good. It's the back strap. And that's the best part of the rabbit. And so, you know, if you're making hors d'oeuvres, that can be like the, you know, you can serve these grilled medallions, and then you can confit the legs like you would with a duck. So each person would get a leg, two people, and then there's front legs. So, and some people use it like fried chicken, but for four people, I would say you'd probably need two rabbits.
And what kind of life cycle are we talking about with a rabbit? How fast do they mature and get ready for processing?
Yeah. Rabbits will, so each female has about 3 litters a year, and each litter is about 10 rabbits, and they grow up and are ready for eating at 2 months. So compare that to a chicken, like an heirloom chicken that you're raising, that or a turkey, that can take up to 6 months to grow and be what you would consider an appropriate size, you know, but like the kind of thing you'd buy at the grocery store.
And the feed is probably similar priced.
The feed is cheaper because it's all chicken feed is, or, you know, grower ration has protein in it. So it has soy or, you know, fish meal or something like that. Rabbits only eat alfalfa. And so it's a pelleted form. It has alfalfa and a little bit of barley in it. So the feed is much cheaper than the chicken.
So two rabbits, a male and a female, can produce
30 rabbits
in a year.
Yeah. And most people have two females and a male just because, you know, it just makes more sense. So you can eat, basically you can have a rabbit a week, once a week, which is kind of, you know, that's a lot. That's like pretty solid.
Novella, why don't you break it down for us in terms of economics? Does this save people money?
If you want to be an entrepreneur and be an urban farmer, you have to really think like, what is my cash crop? You know, how can I make money selling this stuff? And rabbit was a good one because you could sell it at a premium. And like you said, they breed like rabbits. It's not that hard to raise them. And then you can have this specialty product.
Depending on how super survivalist you want to be, there's pretty much everything for every level of urban farmer. The book is The Essential Urban Farmer. Novella Carpenter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It was fun. Choose your own ground. How you live, how you fly. Smiles you'll give and tears you'll cry. All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. Run, rabbit, run. Dig that hole.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bryant Terry. His new book is The Inspired Vegan. Bryant, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here in the kitchen of a master chef. The Inspired Vegan is what number in your cookbook line?
This is my third cookbook and the second in my trilogy of books that will have vegan in the title.
Haven't tasted some of these recipes. We're in your kitchen. Maybe we'll get a sneak peek of some of these recipes. They're not only different in the presentation, but the philosophy behind it seems a little, it's a refreshing twist on what we consider vegan, which is generally not as tasty food. Like, I like butter. I like some of these things that veganism eschews. But you're able to really kind of approach it from a different perspective. You use some flavors that are definitely out of the box. Why don't you walk us through some of the mindset that you had in approaching veganism?
Well, first of all, for me, personally, I live and breathe this work as a food justice activist, as an author, as a chef who cares deeply about people, animals, the economy. I don't care how compassionate / ethical, how sustainable, how healthy food is. If it isn't tasty, if it isn't sumptuous and satisfying, I don't want it. And I know that most eaters feel the same way. So I really think it's important that the food that I create kind of like departs from the stereotype that people have about vegan cuisine, that it's bland, that it's boring, that it's brown rice in a brown bowl with white tofu and brown sauce on it. So, you know, I just want to provide people with good food. And then hopefully, I hope that people will be more interested in learning about, you know, our food system and getting more information about the negative impact that the industrial food system has had on human health, on the economy, local economies, regional economies, on the environment. And then eventually I would hope that it would move people to be more political, understanding that, you know, we can only make so much change as consumers and community members, but we have to exercise our right as our rights as citizens and ensure that we're electing public officials who are working for a food system that benefits everyone, you know, a food system that's healthy and sustainable and not just benefiting rich corporations. So my guiding mantra over a decade has been start with the visceral, move to the cerebral, and then at the political. And I truly believe that providing people with tasty food is one of the first steps to getting people to be more activated around food issues.
As you're chopping some locally grown collard greens, yes, Tell us a little bit about some of the ingredients that you use that aren't as hard to get as people may think, but they also may not have it in their kitchen.
Well, let me start by saying that it's important for me to, in every book that I write from this point forward, to celebrate Afro-diasporic foodways, food from Africa, the Caribbean, the American South that was prepared and cultivated by African Americans. Because I think so often when we're talking about healthful and sustainable food, this type of food is left out of the conversation. I did write a book, Vegan Soul Kitchen, as you know, that celebrated African American cuisine, but I don't want the food to be ghettoized in one book. I certainly want it to be normalized and for people thinking about eating sustainably or healthfully or even like, you know, plant-based vegetarian and vegan food, to think about eating African American or Afro-Caribbean or African food just as quickly as they would any other cuisine. So that being said, you know, thinking about like drawing from the staples and cooking techniques and distinctive dishes of the African diaspora, I really like to use ingredients that most people can get at a conventional grocery store. You know, I don't like to have a lot of specialty ingredients where people have to go to corporate-owned I was about to call somebody out, corporate-owned health food stores to make meals at home. But at the same time, I do want to push eaters, people who read my books, to expand their palates, their pantries, their vision of eating a little bit more. So, you know, people might traditionally use bay leaves when they're cooking legumes. I use kombu. It's a sea vegetable. It helps mineralize the beans. It helps soften them and shortens the cooking time. A lot of people might not know about kombu. You know, it's kind of a traditional ingredient used in health supportive cooking. But I think it's something that, you know, we can push people to think differently about when they're making just typical meals. So it's always that balance of kind of like holding a vision that communities that might not have a plethora of ingredients will one day get to a point where they can have a lot of things, but also understanding that the reality is some people just have a kind of standard supermarket. They don't have a farmer's market. They don't have a CSA program. They don't have food co-op. So I'm always kind of considering all these things when I'm writing the book, and certainly in The Inspired Vegan, I did.
And what inspired you to become a vegan?
Well, first of all, I think I need to say that, you know, when I did become a vegan in the kind of mid-90s, it certainly wasn't a linear kind of journey. There were times where after becoming a vegetarian and then a vegan, I went back to eating cheese, and there were times where I ate fish. I think it's important for me to share that part of my journey of having kind of like, you know, been a strict vegan and then, you know, eating cheese and eating honey and eating fish and then kind of coming full circle being, I guess, what one would describe as a vegan now, even though I don't use that description for my diet. But I think it's important for me to share that journey because I just want people to really be present with the journey, not kind of focusing on some end goal. I'm going to have like the perfect plant-based diet, or I'm going to have the most ethical diet, because I've seen that trip so many people up. You know, when people move from a meat-based diet to eating more plant-based foods, and then all of a sudden they, you know, go home and visit their parents and they have some chicken, or they go out and have some cheese or whatever, then it's kind of all or nothing. Well, I'm just going to go and just, I guess I'll just start eating meat again. And I think it's important for people just to like do what works for them, you know, kind of have a gradual approach if that works. It might not work for everyone to go cold turkey. You know, I think it might be great to be a vegan or a vegetarian at one point of your life, but then later on you might need to shift and change your diet because our bodies are constantly changing. And I think we should have more complicated and nuanced approach to the way that we eat, and I just like to model that.
Well, was the decision a gradual one, and was it more personal in terms of health, or was it more political, were there some other moral, ethical issues involved with not eating meat and dairy products?
Initially, it was very political. It wasn't a lecture or a book that initially kind of catalyzed my journey into just embracing plant-based diets. It was a song, Beef, by KRS-One Boogie Down Productions. You know, beef, what a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. Let us begin now with the cow, the way that it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man, so through his greed, he creates a faster plan. He has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. 21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump. So when I heard that song, you know, such a brilliant, articulate, kind of like, I don't know, just this vivid picture of what factory farming is and the negative impact that it has on animals, it has on the environment, it has on human health, I just morally decided that I couldn't continue to support that type of food system. And so I decided I wanted to be a vegetarian and then a vegan. And, you know, from there, I met this librarian and she directed me to The Jungle by Upton. My dad actually suggested I read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. But when I went to the library, I met this vegetarian librarian and she introduced me to a number of books.
The vegetarian librarian got to you, huh?
She did. You know, she told me about Francis Morlapay's Diet for a Small Planet. She really helped me to move past this kind of like angry reactionary stage and just, you know, encourage me to think more deeply about the environmental benefits of eating a plant-based diet, the benefits on human health, and just to be more compassionate towards others that I might hope to convert. I'll put it like that.
Beef. What a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. Let us begin now with the cow, the way it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man, so through his greed he makes a faster plan. He has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. 21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump. So just before it...
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author and chef extraordinaire Bryant Terry. Bryant, how do you feel about the local food movement when it comes to meat products?
Yeah, it's complicated because one could make a lot of arguments about abolishing the consumption of animal products completely. And I totally understand those arguments, but at the same time,
it's a slippery slope, right? Like, where do you stop?
Well, I just understand the reality of most human eaters. And, you know, there are a lot of people who just aren't willing to give up.
Not just eating. Think about leather and our...
Well, yeah, I mean, even going beyond that, you know, just a number of ways in which our choices as consumers impact animals. But so, you know, I think that it's a start. You know, without putting my judgments on it, I think it's important if people are going to consume animals, that they do it in a way that, you know, is as compassionate as one can be when raising animals. That doesn't support like these big multinational agricultural corporations that could care less about animals, let alone human health. And so, but you know, I have my own kind of moral imperatives around approaching animal consumption. But in terms of veganism, I see veganism as an important tool for addressing the public health crisis that we're seeing in America. You know, we know that 3 out of 4 Americans suffers from some chronic illness that's directly related to what we eat. You know, we're talking about people, American eaters, who are dealing with, you know, preventable diet-related illnesses. We've seen an exponential rise over the past several decades of things like, you know, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, certain cancers that are directly related to what we eat. And so it's not just the folks out here in the Bay Area and Portland and Brooklyn who understand the benefits of vegan, not the kind of stereotypical hippies, but more mainstream medical institutions are pointing to vegan diets as important ways of addressing certain chronic illnesses, certainly preventing certain chronic illnesses. And so I just wanted people to have a tool that, you know, can really help address the public health crisis, but particularly among those who are most impacted, communities of color, low-income communities of color, African-Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, certainly a lot of the more recently arrived Asian immigrant populations. And so, you know, as I say in all of my books, I think the recipe should be used as a guide. If you want to add some bacon grease to the citrus collards with raisins, then by all means, do so. I can't, you know, once I hand them off, they're yours to play with, rework, and remix. But I just want people to feel like they have an option for eating meat-free food that is satisfying, that's sumptuous, and, you know, that is in line with their values.
What are some of the protein substitutes that you prefer?
For some reason, people feel like we have to have like these huge amounts of protein. And I think that one can certainly get an adequate amount of protein through a plant-based diet. I mean, there are a number of, you know, just basic legumes. We're talking about like, you know, I mean, and the inspired vegan, black-eyed peas, butter beans, you know, mung beans, just a number of just like simple legumes that one can get at any conventional supermarket. But, you know, I think while I don't overuse tofu and tempeh, I like tofu and tempeh. And I think that, you know, kind of used with a light hand and a light touch, they're great. I mean, I do this dish where it's Cajun Creole spiced tempeh pieces over creamy grits. And, you know, it's just simply like cooking the tempeh, tossing it in a Cajun Creole spice mix, and then adding it to grits. And I've had some of the most, the most meat-eatingest people that I know who are just happy and satisfied with that. And so I just want to encourage people to just give, you know, some of these dishes a try. I think sometimes people have mental blocks, and, you know, if the food's good, it could just stand on its own, and people will definitely, you know, feel good about eating vegan food.
Bryant Terry, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lee Morgan, Pink Floyd, and Boogie Down Productions.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.